The Ryan Tubridy Show on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Centre Parks. Escape to the forest and make unforgettable memories together.
Hello there and welcome to our weekly podcast. This is a compilation of our best interviews from the last 5 days, all in one place. And so to this week, Derek Byrne spoke to me about Way to Work, which is helping young people in care to put their best foot forward into the world of work. It's got 9:30 on this Tuesday morning and it's great to have your company. I want to say hello to our guest this morning joining us live in studio, Derek Byrne. Good morning, Derek. Good to see you.
Morning, Mike.
Thanks for coming in to see us today. We're going to talk about a number of different things, I suppose. One is about young people in care. And that's not something I'm that familiar with, I have to say, because it just hasn't come into my world. But I'd love you to tell me, when you talk about young people in care, whether they're, what age group are we talking about in this instance?
Well, with the young people I work with in particular, 16 to 21 years of age, but kids come into care like when they're one day old.
Can we talk a bit about that? Who ends up in care in Ireland in 2022?
So from my understanding, there's four different reasons children end up in care in Ireland. It's physical, sexual, emotional abuse and neglect. Mm-hmm. And then also as well, we also have the unaccompanied minors.
Tell me about them.
These are young guys that would be referred to me and Way to Work. The young people that are found in Calais, Greece, by the Red Cross, and they're being trafficked. Some of them are trafficked from Africa. Others have arrived in all sorts of different ways to get out of the countries they're in and try and build a better life for themselves.
And they land in Ireland?
Some of them land in Ireland. Some of them are brought over. From my understanding, I don't really know too much
about
the background.
But that gives us a sense of who's in care. And this is where you come in Way to Work. And that's why we wanted to talk to you this morning, because you've decided there's something you can do with people who are in care and who need a way out.
Yeah. So Way to Work. What we do is we work with, we're a non-for-profit organisation, but fully funded by TIL. So that's the important part. So we work with all the companies and associations across the country. And what we do is create opportunities of employment for young people, whether that be apprenticeship, general operative role, work experience, internship, whatever the young person requests, they're referred to us by their support team, aftercare, social work, all mainly Tulsa. They come to us and tell us what they want to do. Our job is to go and find it for them.
Okay. And how's that going?
Yeah, it's going really well.
Is it?
Yeah. It's going really, really well. Yeah, we have... we've never been told no. Very positive response from all the different organisations. We work with aerospace, we work with motor, construction, retail. The list is endless.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's really well. Yeah.
So you say to them, to people, look, we have these jobs, or so we have these people that could fill your jobs. And they say, I mean, how does work in practice then?
Yeah, getting into the realm is the hard part. Getting by the gatekeeper. Yeah, once you get by the gatekeeper and you get in, you explain
to them. Is that HR then? You need to go, okay, so you're familiar with these. So you get to the gatekeeper in HR. What are you saying to them?
Yeah, so we're getting in and we're trying to tell them what we do. We want to come in. We want to help. We want to work with your organisation. We want to get young people, competent, motivated young people, opportunities in your company through your corporate social responsibility policy. And we do it for free. We don't look for, because we're fully funded by Tulsa, we don't look for percentages. We're not looking for donations. We're not looking for old laptops.
It's a very clean shoot, isn't it?
Yeah, the only thing we're asking for is an opportunity in your organisation for somebody who's been in the care system through no fault of their own. And they need an opportunity, equality and stuff like this.
You know? And do you find most of the people, the gatekeepers as you'd call them, are receptive, or do you have a bit of a battle on your hands depending?
No, once they hear what we're doing, they're normally very receptive. The gatekeepers, they're the key people who are going to waste time.
Yeah.
And in fairness to them, they don't know us, so they keep us out. But once we get to them, to the right people, the response is very very positive. Yeah.
Tell me about the young people. Tell me about the young people that you're dealing with in terms of their experience in life probably has them a little more fragile, maybe even more vulnerable, and going into the workplace, not an easy thing to do.
No. A lot of the young people that I would work with, I would say the biggest barrier is confidence, self-esteem. You go and meet a young person for the first time after being referred, and you sit down. You know, I normally bring them for food. Once you feed them, they normally talk, right?
what do you mean? When do you bring them for food?
So, well, normally arrange to meet up somewhere, a cafe, McDonald's, yeah. Burger King, get them something to eat. Okay. Normally gets them to relax, you know. But starting off conversations, like, they're looking at the runners. You know, they're making eye contact, they're going red, and so on and so forth. I'll give you an example of a guy that I met. He wouldn't even take a burger or a Coke or a coffee off me, and we put him in an organisation called Dublin Aerospace, and he works on the landing gear, and we put him in front of a camera 12 months ago. This guy couldn't look in the eye. 12 months later, he's sitting there talking about how important his role is.
And get away.
I thought I was looking at a different fella, but all he was given was an opportunity where he was able to thrive. That's all he needed.
So how do you get the guy or the girl who's looking at the runners and won't take a burger off you in the fast food joint to, from that figure to the one who's a year later saying, good evening, this is me, this is who I am, and proud of myself?
I mean, I'd like to sit here and take credit for it, but it's actually nothing got to do with me. Okay. It's just a young person gets into an organisation, they're given responsibility, they're trusted, and, they're in, certain environments that can be tough.
Yeah.
You need to be able to adapt really quick. And these young people, as I said, are very competent. They just don't have that uncle or that father to say, you know, Johnny, you have a point on a Friday night, ask him to get us a bit of work. That's where we come in. And we open them doors for them.
You open the doors then. And then the interviewing process. Like, you don't have to have been in care to be scared of the interviewing process.
No.
It's a horribly intimidating place to be. So tell me a little bit about minding and bringing people into that world.
There's many different things we will do. So, I mean, we can go and sit on interviews with young people. We have interviewing techniques that we would go over, interview preparation. We will do a lot of work in the background. So it's not just getting somebody, a young person, a job. We could be working with somebody for 4 months, getting them ready, building CVs, interview preparation, sending them off to do whatever safety tickets they want. Since last August, Tusla have given us the funding now, and they back us 110%. So we now provide training for young people, where when we started off, we were sort of robbing Peter to pay Paul.
Yeah.
We were getting it here and getting it there and so on. So now we're providing it for them, which is fantastic. And
you'd sit in the odd time, would you, for an interview if somebody's just nerves are completely gone?
We could. Yeah, it depends on the young person. Employers don't seem to have a problem with it.
Okay, and if you sat in with a guy at one stage who had to fill out all the boxes, and then you got to the one that you went for. Well, tell me about him.
Yeah, poor fella. I was telling your producer this last week. One of the guys I went and done an interview with, we sat down, there was four of us in the room, the director, HR and accounts, myself and the young person, plumbing apprenticeship. We done the interview, he'd done everything, he passed it, he got the job. The HR lady handed him the forms and told him to fill it out. He filled it out, we were all relaxed, you know, the interview process was over. And she says to him, sorry, sweetheart, you never filled out the next of kin and emergency contact. And he looked at me and he put me down. He didn't have anybody to put down, which is very sad. He had nobody, bittersweet. I'm glad he had me sitting there that day.
Yeah.
But to see a 19-year-old man use me for the next of kin emergency contact sort of shows you the importance of the work we do, you know.
No next of kin, no friend to speak of, no family to speak of.
No, not that I know of. Now, I know his family. I don't think he had a relationship with any of them.
Yeah.
But what I can tell you about him today is, so I spoke to him several weeks ago. We were paying for his driving lessons. He's just returned from Donegal. He's in his third phase in the apprenticeship. And because he's working so hard, he's just got his own apartment.
Great.
Like, he's flying.
So he made it.
Absolutely flying.
It must be really satisfying to see these sort of, younger people who are a bit, as I say, fragile, a bit broken around the edges, but to see them become fully formed and up and running.
Yeah, I think everybody's a little bit broken around the edges, though, aren't they?
They
just need the right supports and the right opportunities, and the rest they can do.
That's for sure. Your own story, Derek, how much of it would you like to talk about in terms of showing us where you're coming from and why you do what you do?
How much do you want to pry out me?
You tell me. I don't want to put you in a corner.
Your producer asked me this the other day. Why am I so passionate, and why is the team at Way to Work so passionate? I mean, I didn't have a great start in life. I didn't have... What did I not... there would have been a lot of chaos in my background. And I understand the significance of someone coming in at the right time and giving you a dig out in life. Most of the really sort of stuff that impacted me in life, advice and guidance, was given to me by professionals, not by, I didn't have parents who were, had the capability to look after.
It was addiction issues.
Mental health.
Mental health.
There was a lot of stuff going on. Yeah. So that went on right through the whole childhood. You know my brother's story. I mean, I told you about that.
Yeah.
You know, he didn't sneak on that plane and get to America because the parents were looking after us 24 hours a day.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And so, yeah, so I understand the significance of getting a dig out at the right time in life.
And you understand the significance of people judging you and putting you in a position that you don't need to be in, or society judging you.
Yeah, yeah.
So how did you emerge then? You came out of that situation you describe. At what age are you now? Do you mind me asking?
I'm 40, 41.
That was a trick question, by
41.
The way. 41. But you answered it correctly. You're 41. And did you at some point in your life as a teenager or even younger again think, why am I in this situation?
Of course.
Why am I listening to the noises coming from the kitchen, or, you know, not getting the love that two doors up is getting? How do you fix that? How does your mind navigate that, the unfairness of it, the harshness of it, the need to keep going?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, I don't really know if I can answer that.
You need
that.
To be strong.
Well, yeah. Well, I mean, another thing I spoke to, just saying to that lady outside, I believe there's two types of people in the world, victims and survivors. I chose to be a survivor. I can't speak for anybody else.
Yeah.
I can't speak for young people in
Care. What was your survival mechanism, Derek? Like, what do you think, looking back, kept you from being the victim? It's too hard to call it.
Yeah, it's true.
No, it's fine.
I just, I suppose, I wanted more. I wanted a decent life.
Okay.
The same with the guys I work with. Some of the young people I work with, Ryan, they'd work 8 days a week, 25 hours a day. These kids that we work with, we shouldn't call them kids.
Young people. And where is that coming from, this hunger, do you think? Is it escape?
It could be, yeah. Mm. It could be. It could be running from your past, and that which, you know, that can drive people to. And I can also want, you know, understanding, okay, so I've seen one side of life, now I want to see the other. With the right opportunities and put in my path, I can see the other.
And did you flirt with the dark side at some stage?
Yeah. I put it this way. I ended up in a lot of situations that I didn't want to be.
Okay.
I never wanted to be in certain situations, but the hand I was dealt brought me to situations which took me a while to get out of, if that's...
And here you are at 41.
Yeah.
As far as you are concerned, you're 41.
I think so, yeah. I hope.
I'm hoping you are. I mean, this could be a total trades description fiasco. But you're 41 and you've got way to work is your thing. Mind
can
you.
I just, yeah, on yeah. that, if I could just, I'd like to take the credit for Way to Work. I really would, but I can't.
Yeah.
It is a collaboration of Tuesday, specifically Donald McCormick and his team in Tuesday. My directors, who are very successful businessmen, who I approached a number of years ago and said, listen, I'd like to do something different.
Yeah.
And they backed the approach Tuesday. And then all the companies like John Siskin Sons, we're official partners with the guys in John Siskin Sons. Designer Group, the big mechanical electrical company, they build a bespoke training program just for our young people.
Right.
And it's like that across.
Well, full across credit the to them, I have to say. Like, yeah. I'm glad you mentioned them, because it takes guts for a company, especially a big successful company, to, you know, somebody might say, you know, somebody less kind might say, to distract themselves with this kind of social justice side of things. But actually, it's very admirable and it's very impressive. And you should take a little bit of credit, because you did your bit, so
you're being
modest, and I accept that. Yeah. But the truth is, you did your bit, and you're happy in your own life now. You've got your partner, and you've got your son.
I am, yeah, I'm very happy in life, very happy in life. I have this for a job. Like, I do this for free, and I'm getting paid to do it. So yeah. I mean, of the best of both worlds.
You know? And what's happening on September 29th?
Yeah, we're launching Way to Work. I was supposed to have an announcement for you this morning, or the press release. I don't actually have it, unfortunately.
That's okay.
But we're launching Way to Work with the Irish Coast Guard helicopters.
Okay.
Well, the CHC. And so, yeah, they haven't given me the press release. I'm still waiting on them, unfortunately. So apologies on that.
Maybe when you're 42, you'll have it.
Yeah, yeah.
Or 39, depending on this
conversation. Maybe, yeah.
Okay, but it's Way to Work. Is the website up and running? People can have a look at it.
Website is up and running, yeah.
Waytowork.ie, yeah.
So it's WAY number 2, a lot of people.
That's
do.
It, yeah.
The T-O, you see, yeah.
Waytowork.ie. Derek, a text from Joe says... what a great guy, totally connected with a solution on the front line, smart and articulate. We need to let the smart, young, educated ones take on these roles to drive solutions without a political bias. Yeah, so there's great hope listening to this interview this morning. Well done. So that's good, positive response. Fascinating interview. It's uplifting, says the text, to know that there is some hope for the youngsters, for those youngsters. So well done to Derek. Derek, thanks for coming in to see us today. And I hope it goes bigger and brighter and better all the way along. Congratulations.
Can I get a plug into your listeners?
Of course you can.
If there's any companies out there across the country who are looking for young people, you know, to hire,
yeah,
to give an opportunity, reach out to us. We'd love to help.
That sounds good. That's a fair cop. Way to number 2 work.ie. Derek, good to see you.
Thanks for
being
here
this morning. 9:45. From catwalk to care home, Ukraine's next top model, Tatiana Brick, told me about leaving behind her life in Ukraine for a new reality here in Ireland. 9:35, joining us live in studio just about after a hectic trip up from Athlone is Tatiana Brick. Good morning, Tatiana. Thanks
Good
for being
morning.
With us this morning.
Thank you so much.
You were born in a part of the world that many of us probably wouldn't have known about up until about 7 or 8 months ago.
Yeah.
So I'm going to do a kind of chronological sweep through, tiptoe through your story, if you don't mind. As I say, you came from Athlone this morning, but let's go to the beginning and where you were born. Tell me about that place and your parents, if you would.
I'm from Ukraine, from south part of Ukraine. Maybe some of you knows the Odessa.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a south part, really small city. And 24th of February, everyone understood what is Ukraine, what is going on in Ukraine. And around like March, start of March, I decided to come to Ireland.
Okay.
But my parents, they don't want to go. They still in Ukraine, still in my hometown. And my mom pushed me actually to go outside. She told me like, Tatiana, go get your work, help us with money, with everything. And we're going to stay here because we don't have any English. It's our hometown. We built this house, like we spent all our life here. So go and you have a life. You need to keep going. You know?
What a nice attitude for them to do that. And they love you so much that they're happy to see you go. That's probably the definition of parental
actually,
love.
Actually, you know, I can tell you that my mom manipulated me, you know.
Your mom what?
She manipulated.
She manipulated
you?
Yeah,
how? She told me like, Tatiana, go. And maybe like if you're going to like start living, if everything going to be okay, we're going to rent a house, me and your dad, we're going to come. I was like, yeah, I'm coming. Yes, I will do this. And then when I came to Ireland, I was like, Mom, I got the job. I have everything covered. All good. Like, we're good. She's like, oh, you know, we're going to stay. Like,
she completely lied to your face to get you out of Ukraine and to make you safe.
Yeah.
But so it was all a bit of a plan, really.
Yeah.
So they're back there. Tell me about your parents. What are they doing for a living?
My mom is a doctor.
Yes.
She's working in a hospital. So basically she's helping to our soldiers. And my dad, he's a bus driver. So
that's their life.
Yeah.
What's the conditions of where they are living now? Because you're phoning home all the time, obviously. And how are they?
Our neighborhoods is Kherson. Kherson is now occupied. So basically it's not really safe in my hometown. And the worst thing is that my parents, they got used to it. So when I'm calling to them, like, how are you doing? I saw the news. It was like bad and like loud at the night, and they're like, oh, like it's okay. Like I'm like, no, it's not. Basically, it's not safe. I don't want to say this, but my father, he just saw it in front of him how people died basically because of the rocket.
Okay, so I saw an explosion and people died.
Yeah.
That's very traumatic for him to have seen that.
Yeah, you know, like it was second time I heard my father crying. He was like panicking because he was like, he was in shock, shaking, panicking, crying, saying, Tatiana, I just saw this. I cannot like unseen it, you know, like, so.
You'd never heard him cry before, or maybe
once? The first time I heard him crying when he When my parents were putting me on, like, on a train to go to outside from Ukraine, it was first time I heard him crying, and the second time when he saw people dying.
In your whole life?
Yeah. Yeah. Now I'm 24, and in 24 years, that was two times I heard this.
You made it, had quite an achievement when you were 15 in Ukraine.
Yeah.
Would you tell us about that part of your adventure in television?
Actually, I was 16. Yeah, I was 16. And, you know, I never thought that I'm going to be a model. It's like I was doing basketball, like normal teenager things, you know, school, basketball, like dancing. And my mom and dad, they were like, you know, you're tall. I was like, yeah, I do.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm playing basketball. And they're like, you're also beautiful. I was like, oh, really? Okay. Yeah. And they pushed me to start modeling. 15, I went first time to Malaysia. So first time I was outside of Ukraine for 3 months alone. And when I was 16, we saw on a TV show, like, hey, like, we're looking for the models for our new competition, Next Top Model of Ukraine. And I was like, Tatiana, this is your chance. This is your chance. I'm like, nah, mom, nah. And she's like, no, you're going and doing it. And I said, no. She filled them, how to say this, like a question.
The form.
She filled the form, not saying anything to me. I was in the training, and like guys from television, they called me later, like, Tatiana, you left the form. I was like, and
no.
You are invited for the television.
To take part. I'm just taking notes, psychological profile of your mother here. Manipulation. We're down again. So here she is. This is where it all started.
But you know, after all of this, I want to say like big thanks to my mom because
yeah, of course.
I'm here now.
Well, I understand.
Here
I understand.
Because of her, yeah.
Okay, so you entered Ukraine's Next Top Model.
Yeah.
Did you do well in that?
I took a third place.
Congratulations.
So I didn't win. But you know what? When I was 22, I came... And get,
you went for another go.
Yeah.
Did you fill out your own form or did your mother fill that one out too?
No, it was like season best of the best or something like this. It's like all of the girls which didn't win.
Yeah.
They were invited for the best of the best part. And I won.
Congratulations. Okay. It's just so peculiar that you'd be, if you were in another world that didn't have a war, you'd probably be doing so many different things. So let me ask you, education-wise, what did you do? What were you achieving in
Ukraine? I'm a pharmacist.
You're a pharmacist, fully trained pharmacist. Let me ask you about coming to Ireland then. What did you know about Ireland before you landed here?
I know Lord of Rings, the movie.
Okay, which was filmed in New Zealand.
Okay. Can you imagine?
Yeah, okay. Lord of the Dance, maybe. But you so you didn't know a whole lot about Ireland.
Nothing.
Okay, so how did you hear about Ireland as a venue?
Basically, I came here with like my best friend. Yeah. And we were thinking, we both know English. And the only country for us, it was Ireland, because Great Britain was closed at that time, and to get visa, it's like really, really hard. And we needed to think like right now what to do.
Get out of here.
And we decided to go to Ireland.
Where are you living now?
I'm living in Athlone in a hotel called Craigan Court.
Yeah.
Really, really nice hotel, really, really nice, calm city. For now we're there.
And is it mostly Ukrainian
whole
people?
Hotel, the whole hotel full of Ukrainians.
My friend Ruslan, who's from Ukraine, who's been living here for years, but who's been organizing events and different things to help our new visitors to the to the island, was kind of always makes the point, and I think it's true every time I meet people from Ukraine, is they say thank you for having us here, but we want to go home now. Is that true? Like a lot of Ukrainian people simply want to go home as soon as humanly possible.
You know, I'm also going to be the first, I think, who's going to buy the ticket when war going to finish. Because Ireland is just an amazing country. People are just an amazing, and I want to say thank you to everyone. But my heart and my soul is in Ukraine, and my parents are also in Ukraine. And, you know, it's sad to say, but you understand what... You lost only when you left it, you know, like we came to like when you're living in Ukraine, maybe like many people from other countries saying the same, you know, like, oh, I don't like it living here. I want to go to some other country, blah, blah, blah.
I wanna
but
see
then,
the world. Yeah.
Yeah. But then
it's taken
when
away
it comes
from you.
To you, you're like, no, I want to go back, like just for our people, you know, our food, our nature, like our beautiful nature and our beautiful Ukraine.
And our family, as you say. You're living in Athlone, you're living in this hotel. Can you work or do you have a job?
I am working currently. I'm working in a company called Bluebird Care. Basically, it's a company which taking care of for people with disabilities, for old people. I'm right now working at the office, but I also want to take part working as a healthcare assistant because I really want to help also to the country, to help people which are helping us. So, yeah, and also my second job, I'm self-employed. I'm employed and self-employed at the same time.
Yeah, of course, yeah.
I'm working as a model.
As a model. So you're are you getting much work in that regard here?
Yeah.
People are you're starting to make phone calls to you and saying
Yeah, I do have.
Did you take courses since you got here? I mean you only hear you're driven, if that, and that's a compliment. You're obviously very determined to succeed and to get ahead and not to waste time.
I mean
my
mum motivated me.
She did. She programmed you and said, get down with her and do everything. And you've done courses as well in what
regard? Basically when I came to Ireland I took 1 or 2 months off because I was like really traumatized of what I saw in Ukraine. And when I came here, I took 1-2 months. Then I went to courses, spreadsheet, reception, payroll. And in July, I got to work. I started to work at the Bluebird at the office.
Okay. Would you like to work as a pharmacist in Athlone?
I've tried, but all of the pharmacies, they were saying to me that they are not hiring right now. Okay. It's going to be November, December, but they wanted to work right now.
Yeah,
you know?
Okay.
So I
found
you
should
other
be working in a pharmacist in Athlone. There's no question about it. You'd be such an asset to these places. You touched on something very quickly, Tatiana, there. I'd like to go back to it for a moment, which you said you were so traumatized when you landed here first. Can I ask you a little bit about that and what was happening in your head and your heart at that time?
Basically, to come to Ireland took me 4 days. What traumatized me is that basically my train station in my hometown, it was bombed, so I couldn't get a train to west part of Ukraine to go to Poland. So my parents, they took me to Odessa. From Odessa, I think it was the worst what I saw in my life. It was like thousands and thousands of people and there was only one train. And when it came, like everyone started to run, you know, and we've been running under like sound of explosions, you know. So everyone thought that something gonna happen, you know, and we were like all running to the train trying to get the seat, you know. And there was kids, there was like many women and like thousands and thousands of people. So basically on the one seat on the train we had 4 people.
Really?
Some people were standing for like 7-8 hours of the train. I was not sleeping at all because I couldn't even sit, you know. When I got to Lviv, it's west part of Ukraine, I was standing in a line for 1 day to get to another train to Poland. And like you see like all people, you know, like crying, kids, everything, no food, like nothing, you know, like some people, they were trying to treat us, the people from Lviv, they were giving like some sandwiches, some water, because some people, they were like losing consciousness because they couldn't stay. Mm-hmm. Like 1 day, you're just standing in the cold, in total cold, waiting for the train. And I was like, there was last train and the train before it. And I was like really, really close to sit in this train. And the guy, he said, we have only 2 people. 2 people to, so train is going. And I was standing, me, one kid and his mother. His mother, he wanted to give this kid to his grandparents, which are in Poland. And she wanted to stay in Ukraine. And she heard 2 people. And she gave me her child. She was like, go, take him, go. And I went to a train. I took this kid. He was not eating anything. I had plenty of chocolate. I was like, take the chocolate. And when we get to closest train station in Poland, I gave this kid to his grandparents. And I took another bus to Wrocław. To Warsaw. I'm so sorry.
Yeah.
From Warsaw, I went to Wrocław because there is my best friend living for many years. And he said, like, Tatiana, you can stay like for some time and decide what to do after, you know. And he has like really, really small apartment, like so small. And there was another Ukrainians in this apartment. Mm. I was like, okay, we cannot stay here because like it's like too much people, you know. I'm thank you so much for helping, but no. So, and I met my best friend already in Warsaw, and we were sleeping in Wrocław in a train station. So we were like buying tickets and everything. We would stay like one or two nights there. And from there, we bought the ticket to Ireland, to Dublin. We came. It was like late night, I think around like 11 p.m., something like this. We were sitting in the airport for like 3-4 hours, I think. And then people, they came and they were like, there is bus, sit. Oh my gosh, it was the craziest I had, you know, like yeah. You're sitting in the bus, not knowing where you're going.
Yeah.
And then, and my phone was like totally recharged, like nothing, you know. And we came to Athlone, it was around, I think, like 1 a.m. in the morning. And there was like security in the hotel, there was a receptionist. She was like super warm welcoming us. She gave us like rooms, and like first time I saw shower, I was like, oh, shower, oh, bed. I think I lost like around 10 or 15 kilograms because I was not eating like anything for like 4 or 5 days. And like, actually, thanks to everyone at the hotel, because they were treating us so nice. They were like giving us food, trying to like really, really like sensitively like take care about us, you know, because like we were like under shock. I was like, I think my skin was like gray color because I was like shaking, not knowing what is going on, where I am, what's going to be.
You've described like something of a World War II film, you know, where the town's under siege, but, and you have to escape.
It's just... There is even worse situation with some. We have some people in our hotel which doesn't have any houses anymore.
Just bombed away.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, I can come back to my family, to my house, and they don't know to what to come back, you know?
Do you FaceTime your parents? Is that how you stay in touch with them? How are they doing?
They are with my dog.
With your dog?
Yes.
You're going to tell me you miss your dog now, of course.
I miss my dog and my parents so much.
In which order? Huh? Who do you miss most, the dog or the parents?
Parents, of course, okay. Parents.
Yeah, I just had to make sure that we're dealing with normal.
You know, I went to see them like a month ago.
Okay. Oh, good. You got to see them.
Yeah,
you
went. I booked a hotel on the west side of Ukraine, where it's like more calm than anywhere.
Great.
They were sleeping for 4 days in a row because like in my hometown, it's impossible to sleep because it's every time like
bombs, sirens,
alarms, everything. Yeah. So
they got to the hotel and said, hi, bed.
Can you?
See you in a week. Okay. But that's maybe that was good for you to see them sleeping. It's probably a beautiful thing too. You know, it's important.
Yeah. But yeah, we every time, like almost every day we're chatting, and my mom has a birthday actually 30th of September.
Congratulations.
Yeah,
Happy birthday to her.
Thank you. So yeah, I'm creating like big, big present for her. And of course, yeah, we're chatting every day.
You're going to send her a present from here?
No.
What are you gonna do?
Basically, my mom, she said that she doesn't want any presents. Mm-hmm. The only present for her is going to be our winning.
Winning the war.
Yeah.
Can you arrange that? Can you fix that?
I can do something for that. So I'm creating a charity.
For
my mother's birthday, we're like collecting money for our soldiers, which are fighting on Kherson.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's going to be her present. She asked me for it.
Is that right? That is the weirdest gift token I've ever heard. But I think in a wartime situation, it makes perfect sense. Holy smoke. Tatiana, it's been lovely to talk to you this morning.
Thank you so much for having me.
It's so good to know that, you know, you're in Ireland and that you're safe and that you're enriching the community that you're living in. And I hope that Ireland is a safe refuge for you.
Yeah, thank
you. But I also hope you get home.
More importantly. And I really want to say big, big thanks to all Irish people which are taking care of us, because when you don't know where to go, what to do, Irish people, they were like, every day helping us.
That's very, very nice of you to say, and I hope people appreciate that too. Tatiana, mind yourself. I mean that.
Thank
and it's been a pleasure to meet you this morning. Thank you so
too.
Much. All right, it's 8 minutes to 10. In The Lost King, which tells the incredible story of how Philippa Langley found the remains of Richard III in a car park. It's more complicated than that, but we'll get into it in a moment. That opens in cinemas Friday, October the 7th. Steve Coogan co-wrote the screenplay, plays John Langley, the ex-husband of Philippa Langley, and the real-life Philippa Langley. Steve, Philippa, joining us now this morning. Welcome to you both, and thanks for being with us.
Hi, Ryan. Hello.
Happy to be here.
Nice to see you, to talk to you, I should say, both again. In the interest of full disclosure, we did a Who Do You Think You Are programme in this country where, I just explained to you, I was the subject of it. It went obviously very close to Republican soldiers fighting in the last century, etc., etc., and then followed the rogue gene all the way through to the College of Heraldry, and they announced to me that I was related to King Edward III.
Oh, wow. Wow.
Philippa, what do you make of that disclosure?
Oh, I think that's incredible. You know, the fact that we can know that today, you know, because of DNA and everything like that. I mean, obviously, that was a key thing in identifying Richard.
Yes.
Steve. How did that go down at home?
It went down like a balloon made entirely of lead. And and the camera crew, who were Irish, of course, who were making the programme, started to bow and scrape when I left that building in full-on mockery. Somebody else sent me a text saying, get out of that Plantagenet garden. And other Greece. So, yes, Steve, quite right. It was received all the joy that you'd expect it to be received. But Philippa's reaction was much more heartening. Let me ask you to do something for us and for our listeners this morning. Philippa, I'll ask you this, if you don't mind, which is really just the potted history of Richard III, because there are people listening in today who really won't know an awful lot about him. So who was he, and what is his role in British monarchy and history?
Right. He was the youngest son of Richard, Duke of York, and was born in 1452. And he lived during a period of turmoil in England called the Wars of the Roses. And he was the younger brother of King Edward IV. And when King Edward IV died, it was discovered that his children by a second marriage were from a bigamous marriage, so they were illegitimate. So Richard was petitioned to become king and was elected king by the three estates of the realm. He was king for about 2 years, enacted a whole great raft of incredible laws for ordinary people, but then was killed at the Battle of Bosworth by Henry Tudor. And then the Tudors began.
Okay.
So that's a very potted history.
No, I appreciate that, and the brevity, of course. And Steve Coogan, this is, of course, one version of the Richard III story. And this is what the film is at pains to point out, that really the version that anyone who's read Shakespeare will know, that he kind of was the version that we have gone on to accept. And I think that's the point here, is that there was a much more nuanced story that got lost in translation.
Yes, well, and really, our film is not just about Richard III. It's about how, you know, the accepted version of events is not always the correct version of events. It's sometimes it's who has the biggest megaphone who managed to get their version told. And it's only when seismic events take place that sometimes history then gets rewritten, depending on what's fashionable or what the agenda is of that time. And certainly the Tudors had a vested interest in denigrating the reputation of Richard III, which they did very successfully.
Yeah.
And there have been a few people who've challenged that sort of version of Richard III, the Shakespeare version, which has become the sort of accepted version, which we feature in the film, actually, before we start to slowly debunk it.
Yes, of course. And there's a bigger question that were going through my head watching the movie if this is so fake news in terms of the version we accepted, where else has history got it wrong? Could go on forever.
Indeed. I mean, like all good historians, they scrutinize things by saying, what is the source of the material? Where does it come from? Who wrote this? Why did they write it? All those questions. And those are the questions that exist even in the present time. You know, why is someone's account phrased like this? Why is it coached in these terms? What's the motivation behind it? Those are just the normal sort of scrutinizing questions that historians and, you know, present day journalists, if they're good at their job, that's what they do.
Yes. There's a historian in this country called Catherine Corliss from the county of Galway, from Tuam. And she just got all the local bits of history she could find and made a grotesque discovery of babies and infants that were cruelly buried in Galway. And the reason I bring this up, Philippa, is because I get the sense from you that you weren't necessarily a historian per se, but you just got completely swept up in the story of Richard III. Was there a trigger point for you where you went, this is so interesting, I need to pursue it?
or was it a series of events?
It was a book. Initially, it was a book that I read about Richard, and it gave you all of the contemporary source material from his lifetime. And it was a 180 from Shakespeare's Richard, because that's who I thought Richard III was, you know, the Shakespeare caricature. So when you actually read from his own lifetime, he's a completely different person. So that really interested me. And then, you know, I visited this car park in Leicester, and I had this unconventional start because there was this letter R on the tarmac, and I thought I was walking, felt like I was walking on Richard's grave. And that changed my research focus, because I was no longer researching Richard's life. I was now researching his death and burial. And, you know, this is what sort of Steve picked up on as well in the film, because, you know, he put that sort of the letter R and everything in there.
I mean, yes, if I can pick up there.
Yes.
What fascinates me about Philippa's story is that it was a combination of intuition and intellect and research. And where those two intersect fascinated me. And it's something that is, you know, we often delineate between academic research and art and creativity. And sometimes it's when those two things combine in a way we don't fully understand that people make great progress.
For sure. And actually, the word I'll alight on from you, Philippa, there was unconventional. Your methodology was unconventional. Your own story was, in a manner of speaking, unconventional. You had ME, which is something that a lot of people arch an eyebrow at. And I think you had, in the years you started searching for Richard, maybe even before that too, a lot of arched eyebrows looking at you going, really, Philippa? Would that be fair to say as an analysis of what you've been facing down through the years?
Oh, absolutely. Because if you go back to when I was starting my research and the search in Leicester, if you go back into Leicester at that moment in time, a couple of local historians suggested that the church, if we think Richard was buried, and it was correctly he was buried there, was under a bank, building and road. So it was totally inaccessible. And that the king's grave itself, Richard was in the River Soar. So the church wasn't there and the grave wasn't there. So I'm doing all of this research, and yeah, I'm getting a lot of rolling eyes at that point. And it's funny because you read things now and they've totally forgotten that. They said, oh yes, we always knew he was there. Yes. We always knew he was in the car park.
Yes, that's one. Yeah, that's one of the great sort of injustices, is a narrative which states, certain Leicester University's narrative, that states the dig started in where Richard was thought to be, which is a nonsense. He was not thought to be there. The only person who thought he was there is Philippa Langley, who's sitting next to me. So there was no widespread understanding or belief that he was in that particular area. That was Philippa alone who, through a research, had come to that conclusion.
Okay, and I appreciate that. What was the overriding thing, Philippa, that kept you going despite people looking at you sideways, saying you look like somebody who's, or you sound like somebody who's quite mad if you think that the king is, the remains are under the car park, and you're also being relentless and persistent, and that's coming across as unhinged? You know, another person would have walked away and said, geez, maybe I am going mad, but you kept going. Why?
Because the research was good. You know, and it really, obviously you don't know until you start digging if the research could be accurate. But I knew we had something to go on here for the northern end of the social services car park, which is where we found him. And the other thing was that we had, and it was the groundbreaking discovery for the Looking for Richard project, which is my project in search of Richard. There's a historian called Dr. John Ashdown Hill had discovered the mitochondrial DNA sequence of Richard III. So, you know, when I'm talking about it and saying, look, we have Richard's DNA to test against if we found him, that's when people sat up and suddenly started taking me seriously. Because, you know, although my research said the church should be here, the grave should be here, they were all saying, well, he's in the river. He's in the river. So what's the point? So, but the DNA was a real clincher, definitely.
Yeah.
John Ashdown Hill is in the film.
Yes, the late John Ashdown Hill, who played by James Fleet. Really good performance, I think.
Yeah. No,
most certainly. And in fact, all the performances are, I think, flawless and perfectly account for the different characters you meet along the way, whether it's opposition or support. Mind you, there wasn't a whole heap of support throughout it. But, you know, Steve, as I was watching this, I was conscious of your involvement in the film. And we've spoken before about another extraordinary woman closer to home who faced a lot of rolling eyeballs and a lot of opposition in her quest for the truth. You know, of course, I'm talking about Philomena Lee. And did you feel that parallel as you were as looking to and about Philippa in this film?
Yes. I would say women who don't have a voice but have a genuine grievance. The parallel wasn't lost on me. You know, I mean, very different story, but also there are certainly parallels with Philomena Lee. When I met Philomena and talked to her about her story, it was extraordinary what she'd gone through. And, you know, and also being up against this huge institution who didn't, you know, sometimes I think it was George Orwell saying that freedom of expression means telling people things they don't want to hear. That's certainly what we had to do with the Catholic Church, tell them something they didn't want to hear, especially the Catholic Church in Ireland. And some of whom kicked back. You know, there's a lot of opposition. But some of them also stepped forward and said, yes, we need to talk about this. Well, we know that telling Philippa's story is telling a story that some people don't want to hear. Well, unfortunately, the horse is bolted and they're going to have to listen.
They're giving it a stink, aren't they? The Leicester University people seem to be deeply unhappy about everything and just reading it around it. Are you going to confront that publicly, or are you going to leave them at it, or how do you feel about that?
No, we're going to, you know, it's sort of gloves off time, frankly. This has been a long time coming. For 10 years, they've held the megaphone and given their account. What we do is redress that. We're handing the megaphone to Philippa Langley. She didn't have a huge resources to employ a PR machine to expedite their version of the story and get it out there and plaster it all over Leicester. She couldn't do that. But we, in telling a film, redress that imbalance and that injustice and put Philippa where she should be, which is front and center, because the facts, the indisputable facts are Philippa Langley led the search for Richard III. Not Leicester University. Leicester University came in at a very late stage, and they confirmed and verified that it was, in fact, the body of Richard III by doing DNA analysis. But to say that they led the search is disingenuous.
I get the sense, and Steve, you can tell me this, but I'll put this to you, Philippa, that front and centre of anything is probably the last place you'd ever want to be.
Yeah, it's not normal life for someone like me, for sure. It's not.
But are you willing to take the hit for King Richard?
Yeah, absolutely, because I think this really helps Richard's story as well, because it brings more of the historical Richard to the screen. Because prior to his discovery in 2012, whenever Richard III was mentioned, it's Shakespeare the whole time, because clearly, you know, he's imbibed in our psyche because it's such a strong character that Shakespeare wrote. But now we've got the historical Richard is now coming to the fore. And that is really, really great news, because people are discovering far more about him from his own lifetime rather than from what the Tudors said about him.
Extraordinary as well in the last couple of weeks with the death of Queen Elizabeth II, who rewarded you an MBE for your work in this matter, and to see the pomp and ceremony around her departure, if you like. And here we are with a renewed interest in monarchy, broadly speaking. There is a strange sense of timing. I don't want to be crass about it, but Steve, I think people will be even more interested in this story and in this film in light of recent events.
Well, I hope so. I hope the interest in monarchy means that we're going to have a discussion about the monarchy rather than just unbridled adulation going forward. But certainly the story of Richard III and the story of ordinary people and what are perceived to be extraordinary people, and that interplay, and how people, some people are celebrated because of who they are or their lineage, and some people are celebrated for what they achieve. Philippa should be celebrated for what she achieved. Richard III is someone who should be celebrated for who he was and what he achieved. And I'd also add to that our late Queen Elizabeth II, who, whatever your views on monarchy, it's indisputable, her legacy and her dedication, which I think sets her apart from others.
It's so curious. We have to go now. I realise that we're out of time, and yet the Irishman and me wants to ask the Mayo man and Steve Coogan whether or not he's a committed Republican in the United Kingdom.
So sorry,
I am a committed Republican.
Okay, we'll have to take it. Okay, I'll take that as your last answer, Philippa and Steve. That's a great answer. That's my favourite answer this week. Thank you very much indeed, Steve Coogan and Philippa Langley. They are the star and inspiration, respectively, for The Lost King, which is a film I thoroughly enjoyed watching last night because really it throws up so many questions and so many thoughts and theories about British history, our relationship with it all. And we could have had a much longer conversation if time permitted. But unfortunately, with these things, it often doesn't. But we'll talk, hopefully, to either of both of those guests on another time and finish off that debate about the Republic and the monarchy at some length with Steve, who's a particularly pleasant guy and a lovely man to meet on and off air. I can tell you that much. All right, let's keep moving on. That film, as I say, is opening on Friday, the 7th of October in cinemas around the country. So that's for your viewing in due course. Let's give you the text number, the 51551. It's 9:34 and Peter McDowell joins us in studio this morning. Good morning, Peter. Welcome.
Good morning.
Freshly minted from a flight from Chicago. Is that where you're from, Chicago?
I'm originally from Illinois, which is, the state that...
That's it for this week. Thanks for listening. Hope you enjoy it.
Chicago's in. I'm from about 2.5 hours south of Chicago, but I live in Los Angeles now.
Good on you for getting from the plane to the cab to the station. Yeah. All in good time. Appreciate it very much. And you're in town because you've come with, essentially, under your arm, a documentary that is, as I would describe it, as a labor of love. How long did it take you to put this together?
It took me 12 years to make this film.
Okay. And the film that we're going to talk about today, Jimmy in Saigon, the clues are one is a brother, the other is a city, and the rest will follow is why we're here to talk about.
Yeah.
I'm going to talk to you beginning with to talk about family, because at the start of your program, when you're wandering around with your camera, it feels very invasive. Your family are obviously private, mm-hmm. and this is a really important part of your story, their privacy, their dignity with that. And here you come with this camera and all generations going, Jesus, Peter, like, give us a break. You know, what are you doing poking that thing around? So you had to, before we get into the story itself, you had to build a trust with the keepers of that story's flame by having this camera in their life. Tell me about breaking that down and making it comfortable for people.
Yeah, I mean, I think it happened fairly quickly in the sense that I got my mom's blessing, my mom, who's currently 98 years old and doing well. But I was her firstborn child who died, you know, my eldest brother. I'm the youngest of six children. And he was the oldest and I didn't really know him. So she understood that I wanted to look for that. That holy grail of finding information about him. There was a lot of mystery surrounding his death.
And the other family members?
I think they took a little while, but they're all kind of on board now. And one of so I have two living brothers and two sisters, and one of my brothers wrote the film soundtrack, wrote the music to the film. And so he and I have been working really closely, and my two sisters have seen it, and my other brother is probably going to see it at some point.
How old were you when Jimmy went to Saigon?
Well,
or to Vietnam.
Yeah. So I was born in 67 and he went to the army in, I think, 69 and went to Vietnam in 1970 and did a tour of duty in the army, came back to the United States and then decided to return as a civilian to Saigon, which was very unusual at the time to return to a war zone like that.
And the war zone was raging. The war was raging. And he came back.
He came back and then he died suddenly and mysteriously a year later.
Okay, and therein lies the rub. Let's talk about Jimmy. I mean, the photographs in the documentary, he just seems like what I would call, and it's coming from me, it sounds really odd, but he just looked like such a cool cat. Like his style, you know, it's all back in, by the way. I see a lot of Jimmys around these days.
Yeah.
He's a really interesting looking guy.
Yeah, you know, I recently was at a festival and I met a woman who personally knew Andy Warhol, and she had a portrait by Andy Warhol in her house. And after she saw the film, she's like, you know who would have really liked your brother? And I was like, who? And she's like, Andy Warhol.
Wow.
And I said, well, why do you say that? And she said, your brother had a really interesting look, and I think Andy Warhol would have liked it.
Isn't that funny? I can see why. Mm-hmm. For a while. So tell me about Jimmy as a boy, from what you know, because there was quite an age gap, wasn't there, between you?
19 years. He was the oldest. He was 19 years older than me. Born in 1948, we're a big Catholic family. We're actually an Irish Catholic family.
It's a shock with a name like that. Yeah.
So, he grew up in a kind of a little bit stifling, like conservative atmosphere in the 50s and 60s. My parents are, not the most conservative, but, it was this conservative time. And I think he found a certain freedom in Vietnam that he wasn't expecting. And sometimes this happens to people. They have to go halfway across the world to start living a more authentic life.
And can you tell us about his admission to the army and why he joined the army?
Well, he had a low lottery number, which means that he was pretty sure he was going to get drafted. Mm-hmm. So he just went ahead and joined. Honestly, I think he kind of enjoyed the rigor, the sort of discipline of the army, the structure, I guess is the word, because, he had been in the university and he wasn't doing well. He was very smart, but he wasn't doing well in the university because people, this is the counterculture revolution. People didn't want to be in school. Yeah. And ironically, I think he found some structure in the army that he enjoyed, but he was ready to go when he left and left the army and then just went right back to Vietnam.
He died after 2 years in the Vietnam War. Again, that's important to the story as to how, what, where, why.
Yeah. Well, there's two main things that I'm trying to discover. The festival that this film is at is the Gays Festival, which is the LGBTQ film festival in Dublin.
Yes.
And the film, it isn't just for or about gay people, but it has a gay theme in it in the sense that I'm a gay man. Mm-hmm. I came out to my family when I was 17. And many, many years later, my mom said, oh, I always wondered maybe if your brother Jimmy was gay. And I was like, wow, you took this long to tell that to me, okay, why do you think that? And then she kind of backpedaled and was like, I don't know, maybe not, So I thought, well, this planted a seed for me. So I was interested, to know, kind of explore. He had a very mysterious personal life. We never knew about a girlfriend. And although he sort of portrayed a Vietnamese woman as his girlfriend, but there was some doubt about that. And then the other was just the cause of his death. And there were a couple different causes, and there was shame in my family. It was a lot of secrets and shame.
Where to go? Tell me about the cause of death, if you don't mind. Can we talk a bit about that as much as you can say?
Yeah. Well, so my parents got a telegram that said that he had died of heroin abuse as a result of or combined with septicemia, which is blood poisoning. I didn't know that until I was 18 years old. I was told that he died of a tropical disease, and that's all I knew. But then when I was 18, I was having a conversation with my sister because another one of my brothers is having some substance abuse issues, and she said, I've already had one brother die of drugs. I don't want another one. And I was like, what are you talking about? Yeah. So then I learned about the telegram. It took me until my mid-late 40s to actually find the telegram that was locked away in a cabinet in our basement. My mom had lost the key, and I said, how am I going to get that telegram out? And she said, do whatever you need to get it out. And I grabbed a hammer and I broke open the filing cabinet and I found this telegram that had been locked away for 40 years. It was incredible.
The telegram was a metaphor, wasn't it?
It was, and in a sense, the cause of death doesn't really matter. I mean, at a certain point in the film, we go into that a little bit more. But for me, when somebody dies young, in my family, it was like, oh, it's a tragedy. It's too sad to talk about. My philosophy, it's a life. It's an exciting life that we can talk about. Like, what did he do in those 24 years as opposed to how did he die or why did he die?
What was your great... So you went to Vietnam more than once. Twice, indeed. And you had a heap of letters, which must have been not only emotional and maybe a little difficult to go through, but wearing a cold documentarian's hat on, very useful.
Yes.
So talk to me a little bit about that and how useful they were to you.
Yeah, I have 200 letters from Jimmy dating from 1965 to 1972. Letters primarily that he wrote to my parents, but there's also some letters he wrote to his friends. Mm-hmm. The tone is very different. He's a lot more candid with his friends about, his illicit activities. And he quoted being interested in hedonistic pleasures. And to my parents, it was much more, much more buttoned up, but I was able to piece together a story of his life.
So why, the big question I think most people listening will be saying, why did your brother get him, not only go to the Vietnam War, but come home and say, nah, not so much, and go back into the cauldron voluntarily? Have you answered that question?
Yeah, I mean, I think so. And I probably can't reveal it on this in this conversation, because that's why people have to come watch the documentary.
That's the twist, yeah.
But I will say that in one of his letters, he said, I can't stand the United States. He said it in capital letters. You know, he was not happy with where the country was. And he saw, ironically, a certain freedom in Vietnam that he couldn't find in the United States.
Even the freedom to be a gay man?
Possibly, yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think that some of those... Some countries were sort of, and maybe still are, in a little bit of a kind of a don't ask, don't tell situation, like where, you know, things are tolerated or people look the other way. Yeah. Whereas like in, you know, the United States at its core was founded by Puritans. And so there's obviously
a strong streak, isn't it?
Yes, it's a strong streak. It's a puritanical thing. And that was, you know, pretty bad in the 50s for sure.
But I thought, okay, let's just go down as a sidebar for a moment, Peter, that... The puritanical thing fascinates me because I just read a book about that, with the Robert Harris book, The Act of Oblivion, which deals a lot about the puritanical beginnings of America as we know it, in those beginnings. And then you have the counterculture you just described there, and we're thinking Woodstock and free love and a tolerance, if you will, that hadn't post-Nixon sort of stuff. Well, actually, it was just pre, but I know, you know what I'm talking about. Yeah. Rock and roll, all that sort of thing.
Yeah.
Liberation, if you like. And then in the last 8 years, back, tiptoeing backwards into that puritanical thing where, no, you can't do that. No, you shouldn't do that. No, you, isn't it extraordinary? I didn't realize how cyclical this was.
Yeah. Well, that's the joy of documentaries also, is that sometimes they bring out things from the past that are also relevant to nowadays. You know, when I first started showing this film to people, one person told me, oh, I don't think young people are going to be interested in this. And it turns out they were totally wrong. Young people love this film. And we try to contextualize history in it and explain the Vietnam War and explain where gay rights were at the time so that young people can kind of understand it, who didn't live through that period. But yeah, I mean, I think as much as we have made tons of progress in the world, there's always backsliding, and it's really important to tell these stories.
What do you think you achieved in the completion of this documentary?
Well, I tell people first and foremost, they say, did you do this to heal your family? And I say, no, I did it to create a work of art, to create a work of cinema, and that will stand the test of time. But if it has healing effects for people who watch it or for my family, I'm thrilled about that. And I'm very touched. We just had our big Chicago premiere and there were 300 people there, and I got, you know, comments about exactly both things, that people loved it as a film, but they also could relate because they had a parent, a sibling, a cousin, someone who died or who committed suicide or who was leading a double life or secrets that shame, you know, in their family. So it is touching people.
Yeah, it covers so many angles, your documentary. And as you say at the beginning about gathering the family around, it the death of a young person within a family casts a pall, a shadow.
Yes.
And you talk about healing. There's no fixing this. Predeceasing of parents by a child. There's no fixing it. There's an attempt to bam, but that's all you can do, I think.
Yeah, people have said, did you find closure? And I said, I don't believe in closure, but I think a piece is something. Peace is something. You know, my mom doesn't want to see the film. She's sort of the star of the film. If there was a best actress category, she'd be nominated for this.
How do you feel about her reluctance to watch this?
I feel fine about it. I mean, she and I had a little email correspondence over the past year where I said, I really hope this film isn't coming between us. And she wrote back the most lovely email that said, you know, that nothing could come between us. And of course, I'm so proud of you and I love you and I love this project. But she said, I don't know what's wrong with me that I can't watch it. And I said, look, it's fine. You know?
I think what seems to be wrong with your mom is that she's a human.
She's a human.
And she's an Irish mammy.
Yes.
She's a fighter. I mean, she got COVID. She's been unwell. She keeps going.
She keeps going.
at 98. She sounds very impressed. What's her name?
Ellen McDowell.
Ellen McDowell. Well,
Ellen Atterbury McDowell. Atterbury is her maiden name.
So. Okay.
But, and she had, we have relatives that came from Ireland in Ardmore.
Oh, yeah.
From Ardmore, the Terry family that came.
Okay,
over,
you did a bit of genealogical search in the past, so you're well grounded here. It's a flyby visit, though. I know you're only doing a one night only, but you can pack a lot into a night as well, you know, Peter.
That's right.
Congratulations on your documentary.
Thank you.
Have fun bringing it to the people tonight, and I'll tell people the details now.
Great.
And enjoy your trip to Ireland.
I wanted to say one more thing, is that I was thrilled to hear you talk about Sinead O'Connor, because she's one of my favorites. And
well, you know what I meant about her being the Cassandra.
I did. I thought it was very moving that you said that. It made me really happy. And
well, she has her own document. Well, it's not hers, but it looks intriguing.
I want to see it. Yeah.
Okay. Well, she'd be glad to hear that.
I hope she gets to hear this.
Yeah, I hope so too. I hope she'd appreciate it, I think. And nice of you to say it. Maria says, what an amazing interview and a movie I look forward to watching, having just completed my master's in psychotherapy of relationship mentoring and taking a deep look at ourselves and our story, which is so painful. But it's also liberating. What an opportunity to look deeply at family of origin and to get a mother's blessing at the age of 98. It's liberating. It's profound. So much pain and hurt in families. I'm from a large family in West Cork and travelled and lived abroad. To have those letters from your long lost brother, how amazing. Writing is truly healing, and I wrote many to my mother that I wish I had today. Unfortunately, none were kept. So you're striking that chord on these different levels today, Peter. It's good to see you, and thanks for your time this morning.
Thank you.
And best to you and your family. As Peter McDowell joining us this morning live in studio. The documentary is called Jimmy in Saigon, and it is screening in the IFI tonight at 6:30 as part of the Gaze, that's G-A-Z-E, the Gaze Film Festival, running until October the 2nd. Loads of details, loads of great films and documentaries. Go to gaze.ie for that. Peter, thanks again.
Thank you.
It's 11 minutes to 10. That's it for this week. Thanks for listening. Hope you enjoy it.